Lecture 22, From Delian League to Athenian Empire.
Ladies and gentlemen, hello again. As we said in our last lecture, the Delian League was making some serious inroads into Persian influence in the Greek world. This was due to the imperialistic policies of Athenian statesmen like Themistocles, Aristides, and especially Cimon. These men expanded the league and brought in new allies into it. Sparta was also a factor in Athenian politics, but Cimon's largely passive policy to Sparta, because of his personal contacts there, kept relations between Sparta and Athens on an even keel for most of the 470s and 460s. But as time wore on, Athens became less concerned with the rights and privileges of its allies in the Delian League, and its continued increases in power eventually led to warfare between the Athenians and the Spartans. The growth of Delian League into empire was slow at first, but it was ominous. And much of our contemporary information comes from the early part of Thucydides' account of the Peloponnesian War. And we talked a little bit about Thucydides last time. This information is in a section of the early part of his work called the Pentacontetia, or the 50-year period, as that word translates. And it stretches from 478 to 431. 431 is when the Great Peloponnesian War broke out. But the year 470 is when things start to happen in terms of the growth of league into empire. In 470, the Athenians sent a contingent of troops against the town of Carystus in the southwest part of the island of Euboea. Using the possibility of the place falling to Persia and hence offering easy access to Attica, the Athenians forced the people of Carystus to become a member of the Delian League. If that wasn't bad enough, in other words, forcing a place to become a member, in the same year, 470, the island of Naxos revolted from the Delian League. Now, the exact reason for this revolt is unknown, but it seems to have been that the Naxians no longer thought that there was a threat from Persia. Hence, they no longer needed to be part of the Delian League. The Athenians sent out a fleet and besieged Naxos, and when it capitulated, they forced it back into the League. As punishment, the fortification walls of the town were raised, and the fleet was seized by the Athenians and added to their own. It was actually confiscated by them. It was also decided by the Athenians that Naxos's tribute, which used to be paid in ships, was now to be paid in money. Now, the people of Naxos had no say in the matter, and they had no real avenue to lodge a protest. As we said last time, if they had appealed the Athenian action, that appeal would have been heard in a court of law, who knows when. And since the Athenians were deciding the issue, we know that the Naxians would have lost out. So what was the point? Thucydides says the incident with Naxos was a turning point in the development of Athenian imperialism. Because, says Thucydides, it was the first time the constitution of an allied city had been disregarded. In other words, the Athenians showed not the slightest interest why their ally revolted. They made no attempt to compromise or address the concerns of the Naxians that had led them to revolt in the first place. The Athenians acted in a heavy-handed manner, and that would set a trend for decades to come. Now, technically, of course, the Naxians could not secede from the League because of the oath of eternal allegiance. This was the oath, remember, that every ally swore to Athens, followed by sinking lumps of iron into the sea. On the other hand, autonomy was an inherent feature of the polis system, so at least the Nexians' concerns should have been heard. So Thucydides' comment, that is, this is the first time the constitution of an allied city had been disregarded, that comment speaks volumes. If we move ahead 5 years now to the year 465 and to the island of Thasos in the North Aegean, this is off the coastline of Thrace. Thasos decided to revolt from the League. Once again, the Athenians ignored the factors that caused the revolt, and they concentrated on getting the island back. It took them a long time. It was a siege of 2 years led by Cimon before finally the Thasians fell. They gave in, and the island was forced back into the Delian League. Note once again the use of force. The reason the Athenians gave for their must have this place back or else attitude was that Thasos was vital to Athenian security in the North Aegean. It was also close to rich timber areas, and on the face of it, these reasons made sense. But the hidden agenda on the part of the Athenians, and here we're really thinking of Pericles, who has not exactly come to the forefront in Athenian political life yet, but he's starting to be someone that we should take an interest in. The hidden agenda was the rich mines on the island. When Thasos capitulated after this 2 year siege, the Athenians took over these mines. In other words, they assumed control of them. They used the mining revenue for their own purposes, not for the League purposes. What's more, the Thasian fleet was taken off the people and absorbed into the Athenian fleet. And as with Naxos, the Athenians decided that from now on, Thasos would pay its phoros, its tribute, in money. Now, all of this is clear exploitation on the Athenians' part, and it's a blatant disregard of allied autonomy. More than this is the Athenians' trend of pinching allied ships for their own navy, of making allies that had originally paid tribute in ships now pay that tribute in money, and also holding allies true to their oath of allegiance. The Athenians were not going to let any ally off. Note also, there is absolutely no concern on the part of the Athenians for allied discontent. They don't want to know about it. They don't want to compromise. This is not the sign of a good leader. As far as the allies are concerned, there is no room for them to maneuver in the Delian League, none at all. And all of these things, what I've just been talking about, are always indications of an empire getting off the ground. But we cannot say either Naxos in 470 or Thasos in 465, or even both together, represent the point where the League has become an empire. We'll have to wait a few more years for that. On the home front in Athens, things were about to hot up. I mentioned before that Persia played a key role in Athenian foreign policy after the Persian Wars, and so also did Sparta. Athenian relations with Sparta come to be polarized in the policies of the two principal statesmen or politicians of the time, Cimon and Themistocles. Cimon was in favor of maintaining amicable relations with Sparta and not risking antagonism. The problem was, Cimon was also an imperialist who was intent on expanding Athens' empire, and we've seen he's not afraid of taking the Persians on in battle. Now, this sort of thing was always going to reverberate unpleasantly among the Spartans. So try as he might to keep relations between Athens and Sparta passive, he was never going to succeed in this, because he wanted to extend Athens' power. Themistocles was the same. He was also an imperialist. He didn't care about Sparta, and if anything, he goaded the place on. This is especially seen in his persuading the Athenians to refortify Athens, to rebuild that city wall, to fortify Piraeus. These things flew in the face of Spartan protests. Remember, the Spartans originally said that no city should be walled except those in the Peloponnese. This difference of opinion over Sparta led to clashes between these two politicians, and Cimon won out. In probably 471, he arranged that Themistocles be ostracized. How we know Themistocles was in Cimon's crosshairs is because we have hundreds of ostraca from his ostracism. And people who do this sort of thing have been able to identify from the way the name Themistocles is inscribed on the ostraca that only about a dozen or so hands, that's people who wrote his name, were actually used. In other words, only a dozen people or so wrote the name Themistocles on thousands of ostraca. So what that means is that Themistocles was always going to be ostracized. As the people went up to the Pinnix to attend the assembly that day, Cimon's supporters were handing out these ostraca to everyone. And as they did so, they were urging the people to use them to get rid of Themistocles. Themistocles, incidentally, one of our more colourful characters that we've met in this early period of this early classical period, this late archaic period, Themistocles went first to the Peloponnese, and eventually he ended up in Persia, of all places. He went to the court of Xerxes' successor, Artaxerxes. And he was killed in the 450s, by the way, in Asia, at the instigation of Persia. So perhaps he never could escape that earlier anti-Persian policy, and it finally caught up with him. Now, after Themistocles' ostracism in 471, and for much of the 460s, Cimon was the undisputed leader of Athens. He was able to dominate just about every meeting of the assembly. That would change, and it would change dramatically in 462, when he was ostracized. And after this ostracism, Ephialtes introduced what's called radical democracy or direct democracy into Athens. Now, Ephialtes died the following year in 461. And that's really the point when Pericles comes to the forefront in political life. Pericles, of course, would dominate Athenian policy down to his death in 429. I'm going to argue that Pericles started the Peloponnesian War. And the term Periclean Athens is often used to describe Athens during the leadership of Pericles, in the sort of 450s, 440s, 430s. But all of this, especially what Ephialtes did, is part of our theme of democracy. And so I deal with it in our next lecture, when we return to our theme of democracy for a while. In this lecture, I really want to get us to grips with how tensions between Athens and Sparta increased and eventually led to warfare. So for that, I need to jump over the nuts and bolts of Ephialtes' democratic legislation for now, and I need to turn to the so-called First Peloponnesian War of 460 to 445. We'll focus solely on Ephialtes' political reforms and what they spawned in our next lectures. But they'd interrupt us too much right now, if that's okay with you. So to the First Peloponnesian War. And the name is really a misnomer, because it wasn't actually a formally declared war. There wasn't really any fighting in it. There wasn't any great battles every year, and in fact, Sparta didn't enter this so-called war until 457, 3 years after it was declared, or rather not declared, because it wasn't really a war. But it's the first time that Athens and Sparta actually come to serious blows with one another, And it's also during this time, it's 460 to 445 period, that the Delian League became Athens' empire. So the First Peloponnesian War and the emergence, shall we say, of the empire are inextricably linked. Now, Athens and Sparta were put on a collision course that led to this First Peloponnesian War because of Megara. Megara was on Athens' western border. And in about 460, it joined the Delian League. Good for Athens. But this action set off alarm bells in Sparta and Corinth. You see, Megara's position on the western borders of Attica there made it of great strategic importance on the land route from Attica into the Peloponnese, because Corinth was a member of the Peloponnesian League. Corinth was also Sparta's strongest ally, in fact, thanks to its substantial navy. Now, what this means is that, in other words, what I mean by Megara joining the Delian League and why this worried Corinth and then Sparta, is that if a Peloponnesian army ever wanted to invade Attica, well, Corinth would obviously allow it through. But Megara could hinder its passage into Attica. Sparta coveted Megara, because then it would have a completely free access route into Attica. There would be no state, no city to put up any obstacle. Conversely, if the Athenians ever wanted to invade the Peloponnese, they would have Megara and then Corinth hindering their progress. So the Spartans are really intent on trying to coax Megara into the Peloponnesian League. This was clearly something the Athenians didn't want. Corinth, in any case, resented Athenian influence so close to it. Not to mention that via Athens' control of the Megarian port of Pegae, which was on the Corinthian Gulf, the Athenians had better access to the trade route to the west. And this was something that Corinth also wanted. In 459, Corinth and the island of Aegina ganged up on Megara. Presumably, they were trying to force the place to join the Peloponnesian League. Now, Pericles persuaded the Athenians to go to the rescue of the Megarians. And an Athenian force sent the Corinthians and the Aeginetans packing, perhaps thinking that it wouldn't be long before the Spartans attacked them. The Athenians then turned to another defensive measure. They built the so-called long walls. And these long walls were literally that. They were a pair of walls that extended from the city of Athens to its port, the Piraeus. These walls were fortified, and they afforded safe passage from the city to the Piraeus and vice versa. They were tall. They had arches on top. So it was like going through this safe passage, getting from Athens to the Piraeus and vice versa. That would enable the rowers to get to the ships safely in the Piraeus. It would also allow supplies to be brought safely into the city if it were ever besieged. Now, needless to say, the construction of the long walls didn't go down well with the Spartans. They knew exactly what the purpose was. And in 457, the Spartans finally enter this First Peloponnesian War. They campaigned in Boeotia, which is the state, as we know, to Attica's north. If their strategy was to hem Athens in between two hostile powers, Peloponnesian powers, that is, and, say, Boeotia, then it blew up in their faces. Again, at Pericles' urging, the Athenians campaigned victoriously in Boeotia. In fact, they won over all of the Boeotian towns, apart from Thebes, to the Delian League. And their successes in Boeotia led to other states like Phocis and Locris, which were to the west of Boeotia. It led to these places joining the Delian League. And even Aegina gave in and joined as well. Now, the problem. overcommitment on Pericles' part is going to cost the Athenians dearly. And this ties in with my comment before that during this so-called First Peloponnesian War, the Delian League became an empire. In probably 457, Pericles embroiled the people of Athens in a campaign in Egypt. Egypt at the time was rebelling from the great king Artaxerxes. And if its rebellion was successful, Athens would gain a rich and powerful ally. The Athenians, of course, would reward it for its assistance. Unfortunately, the reverse happened. The Athenians were completely defeated in Egypt in 454. But Pericles is a clever strategist. He's a good talker. Pericles was able to turn that defeat to Athens' advantage. Because what he now said was that the Persians were likely to sail into the Aegean seeking revenge for Athens supporting the Egyptians. And if the Persians did that, they would probably target Delos, headquarters of the Delian League. Therefore, because we don't want to lose the money, said Pericles, we should transfer the treasury from Delos to Athens. And that's exactly what the Athenians did. And that meant that the treasury of the Delian League was now on the Acropolis and directly under Athenian control. This transfer in 454 of the Delian League treasury was a turning point in the development of league into empire. Because the Athenians now illegally began to use a portion of the allied tribute for their own ends. For example, allied tribute was now used to pay for state officials and to fund a building program. And this building program included the rebuilding of the Parthenon and the building of the Propylaea, this monumental gateway to the Acropolis. It's very interesting, as I said last time, that Thucydides, who writes a lot about the rise of Athenian imperialism, has nothing to say about the transfer of the league treasury. We don't know why, but he just admits it. Then in 451, Cimon's 10-year exile, remember he was exiled in 461, that came to an end and he returned to Athens. Now, Pericles by now in 451 was King Pin in Athens, and Cimon realized he could never replace him, and so he was content to play second fiddle. Cimon negotiated a 5-year truce with Sparta in 451, but then unfortunately he was killed in a campaign in Cyprus in 450. Now, this is also the year, I personally favor 449. This is the time that one event occurred that marked the actual emergence, if you like, of the empire, that marked the end of the league and the empire itself. And that was the Peace of Callias. And it was named this after the Athenian diplomat, Cimon's brother-in-law, actually, who engineered the treaty. It brought to an end hostilities between Persia and Greece. The Athenians promised that they wouldn't involve themselves in Persian affairs ever again. And in return, the Persians promised to stay out of Greece. So, in 449 then, the anti-Persian mandate of the Delian League had been fulfilled. Technically, we could argue the League could now be disbanded. But the Athenians kept the League in existence by force, with themselves as its hegemon, and they adopted a very different attitude to their allies now. After 445, for example, the Athenians referred to their allies not as allies anymore, but as cities subject to Athenian rule. Wow, that speaks volumes. The empire has come into being. The year 445 was also important because it was when Athens and Sparta made peace in the First Peloponnesian War. This peace was called the 30 Years' Peace. The treaty ended hostilities because all of a sudden the Athenians found themselves hard-pressed on many fronts and a great deal of their power collapsed, so they had no choice but to make peace. They'd lost a substantial number of men and 200 ships in Egypt. Earlier, in 456, Euboea had revolted from the League. And to make matters worse, Megara followed suit. Megara revolted and became a member of the Peloponnesian League. And then finally, the Thebans undid all of the Athenian successes in Boeotia. In fact, Thebes now established itself as hegemon of a Boeotian league. Under the terms of the 30 Years' Peace, Athens was supposed to give up all of its newly acquired possessions, though in practice it didn't do so. For example, it wouldn't allow Aegina to leave the league. More importantly for us, though, as we start to consider the causes of the Great Peloponnesian War, as I'll talk about soon, the one that broke out in 431, the 30 Years' Peace also laid down some important stipulations. First, that neither Athens or Sparta was to interfere with each other's allies. Second, no allies were allowed to transfer from one league to another. That meant that Megara would have to stay in the Peloponnesian League. The Athenians don't like that. And third, each hegemon, either Athens or Sparta, could use force to deal with conflicts as they saw fit. Now, the Athenians continue their heavy-handed approach to their allies over the next decades. So, for example, in 440, Samos revolted from the league and then got involved in a dispute with another member, Miletus. The Athenians supported Miletus because it was a democracy, and they sent a large force of 40 ships under the command of Pericles against oligarchic Samos. After a 9-month siege, the Samians capitulated, and as punishment, they had to raise their walls, surrender hostages, hand over their fleet, and pay war reparations of the equivalent of 3 years' tribute. And the Athenians also set up a democracy there. Needless to say, the Athenians came to be disliked for their extortionate practices and their despotic ways of controlling their allies. In addition to what we've been talking about, they sometimes placed garrisons or governors in suspect allied cities, and they established clerarchies in allied land. Now, unlike a colony, which was a city founded in a new place, it was a completely new foundation, a clerarchy was an Athenian settlement founded by displacing the native peoples who lived there and then seizing their lands. Now, this practice of establishing clerarchies went against the very essence of the polis system, and the Athenians were hated for it. We can understand why. They were hated also for their illegal use of allied tribute for their own ends, for their disregard of the allied council or Synhedrion, and for the increases in the amount of tribute each ally was to pay over the years. But despite all of the Athenians' actions, there was never any large-scale revolt on the part of the allies. Even during the Peloponnesian War itself, when the Athenians were twice on their knees and completely vulnerable, no widespread rebellion occurred. Now, this doesn't mean that the Athenians were popular leaders. Far from it. Otherwise, we wouldn't have been talking about the revolts that we have been. But perhaps the reason why the allies stayed loyal to Athens was because of the economic and trading benefits that they enjoyed from membership of the league. These benefits increased their own prosperity. Although the argument can be made that the league should have been disbanded after the Peace of Callias in 449, and hence that the Athenians were again acting to the disregard of allied autonomy, the future was always uncertain. There is a reason for the Athenians keeping the league together by force. This reason is the security of Greece. The Athenians felt that they had to keep the allies together, and so they acted in whatever way they thought fit to ensure this. Because you never know when Persia would come back. Whether the Athenians intended from the outset to turn their league into an empire to counter the Peloponnesian League, or whether this was something that developed over time, is difficult to answer. My own view is that it developed, but that it didn't take too long to develop. So also hard to answer is whether the Athenian allies didn't realize the implications of their oath of allegiance, Or did the Athenians take advantage of them from the outset? Well, it's a bit of both, maybe, though I hate to say that because now I'm fence-sitting. The First Peloponnesian War was merely a prelude to the Great One of 431 to 404, and we're now at the cusp of that, so to speak. But before we consider this war in any detail, we're going to look at the tremendous political change in Athens that unwittingly the imperialistic policies of people like Cimon and Themistocles brought about. This change was the opening of the door to direct democracy, the result of the legislation of Ephialtes in 462. We need to know about this change so we can better understand the workings of the democracy during the Peloponnesian War era. What did direct democracy actually mean? And what did it mean for Athens that the people were sovereign in the state? So in our next three lectures, we're going to return to our theme of democracy. Because when we get to the Peloponnesian War, I'm going to argue that it's the radical democracy that lost the war for Athens. That's right, bit of a heresy on my part again. The political system that the mass of the Athenians cherished the most ironically did the greatest damage to the city. It wasn't losing that final battle that lost the war for Athens. It was its political system that lost the war. And we'll start to find out how and then why beginning in our next lecture. Thank you very much.